Welcome back to the second of my rambling thoughts on nationalism, patriotism, state violence, religious photo ops, and especially why do evangelicals and charismatics seem to continue not only to quietly support, but with enthusiasm, support the aims and the methods of Trump, of the Republican Party, and underneath it all, broadly speaking, of the American way of life. This is an issue that has now caused so much problems in the world, and other Christians are getting very distressed. And I'm getting emails from all over the world, including from within the United States. And if you want to hear more about that, that's in episode one. Before we get on with the meat of today's episode, first of all, you might be able to hear some lawn mowing going on in the background, as well as some birds tweeting. This is because I am recording from my garden shed, and the neighbor is doing their lawn, and I do not have the heart to tell my neighbor to stop taking care of his lawn just so I can go on and on and on about evangelicals and Trump. Seems to me to be a misuse of power in that case. So let us love our neighbor and let him chug away with his lawnmower. The other thing to say is I got an email from Steve S. Steve S. is a lovely guy, a good friend of mine. He and his wife, Isabel S., have both written to me. And Steve asks for some more resources about how to wean oneself off the sort of Christian culture that just leads inevitably to these kinds of things, and how one could start resourcing followers of Jesus instead. That is a great question, and in fact, Steve and Isabel, I have decided to devote an episode to this, or at least I will be putting some great time into it. I'm going to put something up on the website as well. I have been collating a lot of information. There is a lot of people out there, and I'm going to talk about it later on, but I just put this at the front now of the episode so that people know there is good material out there. We can do it. There's good people, spirit-filled, loving, kind, generous and gracious and intelligent, educated. They know their Bible. You don't have to keep reading the same stable of authors, their self-published paperbacks from vanity presses. Stop reading those people. Stop reading self-educated, unaccountable people. They might be good-hearted, they might be generous and kind as individuals. They don't know what they're talking about. You'd be surprised how little these people actually know anything they're talking about. And just being published in a book from a press that you basically helped to set up yourself does not make you an authority on anything, because your ideas haven't been tried and tested. They haven't been put through the ringer. They've been rubber stamped and pushed through. There's a lot of good resources out there, and we're going to talk about that later on. So today I want to continue with the conversation. It is rambling thoughts. I'm not going to answer all of your questions. I just can't. It's impossible. Some of these questions, such as why do people do this, or why, what is going on? You know, the Apostle John, in the Gospel of John, he said, men love darkness because their deeds are evil. People love evil. I don't even know what else to say. Sometimes it just comes down to that. People do love evil, and they need to cling to it. And you see this happening, and it doesn't matter if they call themselves Christian. What I noticed before in the previous episode was we need to stop even using that label. The label is becoming meaningless, if it hasn't already become meaningless. Followers of the way of Jesus is a much better way to talk about what it is people who like Jesus are trying to do. Because you can call yourself a Christian and support all manner of things under the sun. As we can see, this is evident. This is not even controversial. People who self-identify as Christians support every political ideology. They run the gamut in terms of violence, in terms of money, in terms of sexual freedom. They run the whole spectrum. Calling yourself a Christian is such a wide label that it is basically not a very useful label. But you cannot support every position under the sun and call yourself a follower of Jesus. followers of Jesus have put on Christ, as it says in the book of Galatians. They are clothed with Christ. This doesn't mean that we are striving in some sort of holier-than-thou, works-based, do-gooder type activity. It means that we are moving through the world trying to live with Christ and in Christ and he in us. I'm reminded of Matthew 11:28, where Jesus is telling his followers, he says, "Come to me, all who are weary, and I will give you rest." And so often we might think in our imaginations, we might go to the idea that Jesus here, he says, "Come to me, all who are weary, and I'll give you rest. For my burden is light, and my yoke is easy." So a lot of us will instantly go to farming metaphors, and we think of the agrarian culture, and we think, "Ah, okay, I know what a farmer looks like. A farmer sits on the plow or stands behind the plow and then chains his oxen to the plow. And then he yokes them to the plow, and then he gets his ox to pull the machinery and do the work." And Jesus here is saying, "I'm a good farmer. I take care of my cows. My yoke is light. Don't worry, the job I'm giving you to do is easy," or something like that. But we miss the fact that Jesus isn't saying he's a farmer. He's saying, "I'm an old cow. Yoke yourself to me, and I'll show you the ropes." If you want to train a young cow how to plow a field, you attach them to the old cow, who already knows, who's developed the muscle memory. And this is what you do. You yoke the young, untrained animal to the older animal, so that the young animal learns by behavior, learns by following, learns by simply being next to the experienced one, what to do. Jesus is saying, he's not saying, "I'm the farmer with a light whip and a light chain." He's saying, "I'm an ox. Come and plow with me. Come and do the work with me. Follow my ways." He's not even saying, "Become a moral agent who knows right from wrong." He's saying, "Follow me. I'll do it for you. Go where I go, be what I be, say what I say, look where I look, and you will learn the right ways." So it's an invitation to co-labor, it's an invitation to move with Jesus, it's an invitation of Jesus saying, "I am always with you." But it's not an invitation to being some sort of moral hero, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, go it alone, be by yourself out in the cold dark. Because the world is dark. And you trying to determine what's right and wrong all by yourself is impossible. And even if you could figure it out, you couldn't do it. Because the system, the world is against you. The men love darkness because their deeds are evil. And we're facing evil on an organized, generational scale. We always have, but we're seeing it pretty clearly now for our generation, what we're facing. Institutional racism, inherited patriotism and nationalism, forms of life that the people who have them cannot imagine not having. They cannot imagine that it might be bad. This is what we are coming up against. And the followers of Jesus, as opposed to the Christians, the followers of Jesus are saying, "We are just going to go where he goes, and we're going to be where he is. And that's our measure of goodness. That's going to be our measure of success and purpose in life." Eugene Peterson, in his translation of the New Testament called The Message, he writes Matthew 11:28 as Jesus saying, "Come, take a walk with me and learn from me the unforced rhythms of grace." And I think that's what I want my watchword to be. I don't know how else to describe it, but this is my heart's desire, is the unforced rhythms of grace. And you need to be honest and ask yourself, look at the people who speak the most loudly in the name of Christianity today. Look at the people who are lending their voices and their resources and their money and their public platforms in the public sphere to defend Trump, for example? Are you finding unforced rhythms of grace? Can you, in your heart of hearts, see the fruits of the Spirit? Is there any love, joy, peace, kindness, patience, gentleness, self-control? Do you see any of these things coming out of the material that the conservative evangelicals and patriots, not the liberal media bias, not the way that they've been twisted, because I admit that they do get twisted. There is such a thing as a liberal media bias. I'm not going to argue that. But I'm not saying look at MSNBC or look at CNN to see what evangelicals and Republicans say. I'm saying look at their own words. Look at the things that they themselves want you to know about themselves. What is the thing, if you were an alien observing the world, what would you learn about these people's visions and hopes and aims and methods just by looking at their own words? Look at the tweets or the social media output of Robert Jeffries, of Franklin Graham, Liberty University. Look at Fox News. Look at the approved and openly supportive partisan voices. Not the liberal media enemies. Look at the friends. Look at the people that claim to be speaking for Jesus or for rightness or goodness. Just look at a Facebook feed. Go and read conservatives talking to themselves about... go and read conservative Christians and charismatics talking to themselves about their enemies and about their politics. Well, I get comments all the time, or I read them on Facebook or in other places, and they almost read sometimes like Russian bots. They read like caricatures of what enemies of conservatives are supposed to think. But these are people themselves writing. They call themselves Christians, and they're spewing hate, lies. They dismiss people very quickly. They call on violence upon their enemies. There is no truth or life here. There's something wrong with the culture. The discipleship has failed. The ability of the evangelical culture, by and large, to instill in its people a Christ-like imagination, a political imagination for how to move and work in the world and how to treat one's enemies and one's opposing systems, is absent. And this isn't because I'm reading some elite liberal writing from a New York media office. It's because I'm reading the Sermon on the Mount and the Fruits of the Spirit. And it's by that measure that we can see that the people who cry, Lord, Lord, are quite often not followers of the way of the Lord. So the question now remains is, why do Christians support this, and why are they so sucked into believing these narratives of fear and power and domination over enemies? And this is what we want to start looking at now. This is a Catherine C. She just wrote one very simple email question to me, which is, why? Why do they defend this? Why do Christians defend this? And by this, I think my friend means the whole world that has led to this point where such a man and such a movement is seen as the culmination and the protection and the defense of the Christian way of life. Charlie M. also writes something similar. Oh, and apropos of absolutely nothing, I recommend you check out the book The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse, for no particular reason. In any case, Charlie M. writes, what in the world would Trump have to do to lose his evangelical following? Now, this was written on a Facebook post, and there were a few jokey suggestions. One person writes, Stuart H. writes, and apropos of absolutely nothing, perhaps you should go and look at the movie The Shack. Don't know why I mentioned that, but anyway, Stuart H. wrote, well, perhaps Trump would have to convert to Islam to lose his following. Now, this made me think. Do you know, I don't think Trump converting to Islam would actually have that much of an effect. I'm not saying it would have no effect at all. But Trump has not proved himself to be an articulate Christian. He's unable to answer even the most basic questions. There's a YouTube interview of somebody asking him his favorite Bible. He says the Bible is his favorite book, and then they ask him, what is your favorite verse? And he can't do it. There's a high likelihood that he doesn't even know a single verse in the Bible. He's unable to articulate or express any awareness of basically the most basic tenets of Christianity. And he certainly doesn't express or reflect anything like a life that is trying to be conformed to the image of Christ. He's never shown repentance of anything that he's said and done in the past. And he continues to double down on these things. So evangelical Christians, if they are watching him, I suspect there's a lot of evangelical Christians that aren't actually even looking at his own words. I suspect there's a large amount of Christians in America who get their view of Trump from Fox News and other media outlets that are already positive or predisposed towards him. I think a lot of them don't even read his own stuff, to be honest. I suspect that might be the case. Because his own words, his unfiltered thoughts, contain absolutely no evidence of any sort of following of the way of Jesus. To be honest, I suspect that the only way Trump would really lose the hearts of the evangelical Christian base, by the way, 81% of evangelicals voted for him in 2016, I think the only way he'd lose that support is perhaps if he publicly denounced America or publicly said he was going to take away the Second Amendment and remove the right to bear arms. And ask yourself in your heart of hearts if you think I'm right or wrong there. I think that, again, the patriotism is a stronger element than the religion, because Trump has no religion and he doesn't show any effort to actually respect the religion. What he does show is his ability to use the language of American dominance and power and individual freedom, the American view of freedom and self-realization. That is the buttons he is good at pressing. And I think if he stopped pressing those buttons, you would see the evangelical support dwindle. Which leads me to this whole question of why. Why was this happening? My friend who lives in Texas points out that amongst his friends and family who are Trump supporters or who are conservative politically in that way. All right, there's two types. There's a type that actually thinks that Trump is a Christian and they pass around the memes and they believe the sentimental stuff. But then there's another group and they are more aware and they know that Trump is not actually a Christian, but they like him because he champions their cause, because he's a tough guy. This is the Robert Jeffries line. Jeffries is the pastor of the big church in Dallas. He's a very vocal Trump supporter, and in a quote a few years ago, he said, I don't want somebody like Jesus to be my president. I want the meanest, toughest son of the bitch in the room. And again, he's absolutely, in his own words, confirming what I said in the last episode, which is, you can't run a country according to the Sermon on the Mount. The way of Jesus doesn't actually let you be very patriotic. And if you believe that your country needs to succeed, then what you need is the kind of person who's going to do the work that's going to get that country to be dominant. The nationalism narrative is the most important one here. And so Robert Jeffries and others who are aware that Trump is not some sort of paragon of Christian virtue don't care. They don't want a paragon of Christian virtue. They want a bully. And they tell you that overtly. This is not liberal media bias. And a lot of people who are in that camp of supporting all this stuff, they look at Trump bringing in tear gas and state police to clear out protesters in order to stage a photo op in front of a church that he doesn't attend to hold up a book he doesn't read. And they like it. they liked the fact that he used the law and order and authority. This is all heavy air quotes, by the way. He likes the authority that he projects, and they rise to it because this is what they want. They want this kind of authoritarian figure, and he knows it, and he is doing these messages for them, not for anybody else. So this is where I think we need to start looking, is what is it that the aims of these people who call themselves, well, they are Christians, I'm not denying they are Christians, what I'm saying is they're not followers of the way of Jesus. What are the aims of these Christians that are being met that could result in somebody being so popular amongst them? He's giving what they want. He's given them the Supreme Court justices. He's given them some of the right moves on abortion law, and some of the, he's giving them the language they want to hear. He's giving them the ramped up gun rights. He's using all the quote unquote right language about race, about there's good people on all sides. He's using the language that they want to hear about Antifa, which is the anti-fascist movements. And he's lumping all enemies of the conservatism in with Antifa. And people like that. This is working. Every time Trump insults a Democrat or a liberal, it works. Every time he makes these messages or projects these images, it works for the base that it's aimed at. Okay? And the madder that the rest of us get, the better he is with his base. He's doing something that the people who support him want. And what do they want? They want to take back control. They think they've lost their nation. And everything comes back to nationalism again. Even abortion is a subheading under nationalism. I grew up listening to James Dobson, Focus on the Family. I grew up being taught conservative evangelical apologetics in school. I went to a Christian school. And all of the input that I had was coming from American right-wing culture, even though I was living in Canada. And I can tell you that even then, in the 80s and mid-90s, this is well before the advent of the internet and post-fact, fake news kind of world, the narrative was very high that they are out to get you, the liberals hate you, the world has lost its ability to know the truth. We have lost control. The culture war mindset, the idea that you must be raising up your children in order to fight the culture and take it back again and win it for the Christian cause, was very high and very prevalent. And it was a combative and fearful-based way of living, which is that everything is an assault on you, they are out to get you, and you need to fight for every inch of your rights. And this is where the gun rights, the abortion, and all the other things get lumped into that, because what's happening is we've lost the narrative of our nation. We need to control it again. We need to protect ourselves from the liberals or from the secularists and all that. And again, underneath it all is the idea that this nation was given to us by God. We have a manifest destiny to spread out. We are a light shining on the hill. We're a city on the hill. The language that American evangelicals use for their nation is frankly lifted from the Bible. It's the same language that Jesus used about himself or about his kingdom. And without missing a beat or apparently noticing what has happened, Americans use that language for their own country all the time. There was one point where George Bush, during a memorial for the victims of 9/11, he said, "America shines like a light in the darkness, and the darkness does not understand it." Now, I'm not so concerned about whether Bush or his script writers understood the Bible or not. What I'm concerned is that the evangelical base for whom this language was aimed lapped it up. They heard Jesus being substituted for America, and nobody batted an eye. And this kind of thing happens all the time. The Winthrop, when he, the Puritan, who when he said America is like a city shining on a hill, which were then words that were revived by Ronald Reagan, is a direct co-option of New Testament language for the kingdom of God, the people of God. And it's been co-opted now so that America is this thing. And nobody seems to notice. This is what the theologian William Kavanagh calls the migration of the holy. The things that used to apply to Christ or his church now apply to the nation, and specifically in this context to the American nation. And so that people who would never kill in the name of their church would be horrified at the idea of killing in the name of the church, actively endorse killing in the name of their country. That's a migration of the holy, of what they think is sacred, of worth dying and killing for. And this is the narrative that whole generations of people have been brought up with. And it's underneath it all is a patriotic nationalist narrative of this nation is God's latest revelation. It's been chosen by God. It's exceptional, American exceptionalism, which means we are exempted from the rules. History has changed with us. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution are treated as sacred. The flag is treated as sacred. And if you don't believe me, just look at what happens to these documents or these flags if you try and insult them or attack them in any way by Americans. These are treated as sacred texts, not as human inventions. And the exception is that every other country might have its rules and laws, but we are the ones that are chosen by God to be a light to the rest of the world. And so you need to raise up defenders of this thing, and you need to control the narrative again. Behind this is raised, charismatics will be aware of the Seven Mountains ideology, which is the idea that you need to, in order to really control culture and change the culture, you need to get your people into positions of influence and power in the arts and finance and business and government, and these seven regions are identified. And this is taught in lots of places, including Bethel and others. And I was brought up with this, even in Canada, I grew up with this. And the Seven Nations is comes out of a movement called Dominionism, which is a movement that of the right-wing conservative patriots who are overtly realizing they need to take back the narrative of their nation. They need to take control. They have to have dominion. It's part of their mandate from God, they think, to have dominion over. Some of the voices here would be Rick Joyner, Maurice Murillo, Lance Wellnow. These are people in the prophetic, charismatic stream. All of them, incidentally, constantly and continually given space and platforms in the Bethel Ministry School and endorsed by Bill Johnson and others. In any case, dominionism is an overtly nationalistic theology and ideology, which is based on control, taking control from the secular humanists, as they're called, or the liberals, as they're called. It leads itself very well to conspiracy theory thinking, which is why these people that I mentioned are also very much involved in that. The idea that there is a liberal elite that is taking control, that there's a spiritual war against America, and that it's a cabal of, you know, child sacrificing atheists and Jews and whatever who are taking things over. These conspiracy theories have been around for a lot longer than coronavirus, I can tell you that. It wasn't 5G that invented the conspiracy theory. And charismatics are particularly well primed for conspiracy thinking because they also have, for reasons we don't need to go into too much here, but they have an eschatology which the Antichrist and the beast loom very large in the charismatic imagination. And the idea that there is going to be one world government and one evil ruler who's going to manipulate and everything, control everything, that is conspiracy thinking. And so charismatics especially, and evangelicals, are always looking out for the beast, and they always think they've identified the beast. They always are identifying something as the beast, by the way, and it never is. Or perhaps more accurately, it always is the beast. If you read the book of Revelation, you'll realize that the beast is any system of organized domination which attempts to set itself up against the way of God. And so, yes, there are lots of beasts out there. But I digress. Why would I say that abortion was the subset under nationalism? So the most common narrative is that Christians love Trump because he's delivering on abortion. And there is some truth to that, obviously. I would like to call out the lie, however, that there is a narrative out there which is, evangelicals, they don't like Trump. They see Trump as the one who's bringing in what has to be done because America has lost its way, because it's gone so bad that we needed a ruler, a King Cyrus type figure who's going to come in and whip us all into shape, and that we've sunk so low that we need an evil tyrant ruler like a Trump, King Cyrus figure. And so that there is, and that the abortion is part of this narrative, okay? And that it, what it takes is, because America has lost its way, it takes a figure like this to put it back on its rights again. Now, the problem with that narrative is that if that really was the case, if it really were true that American evangelicals see Trump as the punishment that they deserve, you would see a whole lot more, "Woe is us. We have come to this. Woe is us that we have lost our way to such an extent that a man like this with tactics like that have to be what we need, that we deserve." But you don't see a "woe is me, woe is us" attitude. You don't see American evangelicals repenting of their ways, of seeing their nation and their part in their nation as being worthy of punishment or discipline at the hands of King Trump. What you see is wild, gleeful enthusiasm for him, not just for abortion. You see the wild, gleeful enthusiasm when he talks about gun rights, when he talks about racism, or doesn't condemn racism in any full-throated way. You see the enthusiasm for the way that he treats the Palestinians, and he favors a very narrow and certain violent form of Jewish Zionism, which is what motivates a lot of American evangelical support. Again, it's based on nationalism and the nationalistic logic. And finally, very much the Trump support of the military is cited very often in amongst evangelical and charismatic circles as a reason to support him, because he's a friend to the military. So again, these things go far beyond just abortion, but what they do is they lean all towards making America great again. This is the reason, this is the underlying reason, that they're all about getting the right people in power, in places of power. The fact that Trump was able to put various Supreme Court justices in place was another motivating factor for American Christians. But what's happened is they've gained the whole world but lost their souls. They've won the battle but lost the war. Because the tactics that these Christians are endorsing and with glee, with absolute open-armed enthusiasm, these are tactics that derive nothing from the way of Jesus. So a lot of Christians are very good at using the Bible, or they think they're very good at using the Bible to determine what's good and what's evil. But then they're absolutely terrible at using that same Bible about what to do about good and evil, and how to be in the presence of evil. And there's no sense here, there's no attempt or appetite for submission, for turning the other cheek, for patient endurance, for witness to the powers. All there is a pragmatic and utilitarian might makes right attitude. The idea that if we could but get all our people on the right panels and right boards, then we could ram through our agenda. Now, abortion is a really hot topic. It's a really important topic. So I'm going to deal with it in the following episode so that this one talk doesn't get too long. I'll see you in the next session.